This is LIS Radio, a production of the School of Information Science and Learning Technologies at the University of Missouri Columbia.
There you have it, folks, the beautiful Missouri Waltz by, who did that one? Lawrence Welk. The show is Show Me Libraries, which is about, no surprise, libraries and librarians in Missouri. This is your host, Charlie Seavey, sitting in tonight for the next half hour of a pleasant chat. If you call in, the toll-free number is 866-768-5483. That's 866-768-5483. Or if you're in the Columbia area, it's 884-3803. And just in case you really don't want to talk, I have my trusty laptop open, and you can email me at seaveyc@missouri.edu. And if you do get on the air, if you do call in, remember to turn off the sound on your computer, or we get this nasty feedback loop thing and you and I will both be deaf, and who needs that? Our guest this evening is Carolyn Trout, director of the Joplin Public Library in Joplin, Missouri, a stone's throw from both Kansas and Oklahoma, as luck would have it. And I'm going to have Carolyn come on here for a second, and then I'm going to pop her a question. Carolyn, you there? That's a most excellent thing. We need to have you say a few more things because I could just barely hear you.
What would you like me to say, Charlie?
Well, just keep talking for a minute or two, and Jennifer and the tech crew are madly pressing buttons here.
It's a pleasure to be on your show.
I'm glad to hear it.
Am I coming through better for you?
How are we doing here, gang? Okay. The gang says, okay, I got four people lined up staring intently at this massive communication system we have here. So you probably knew this was coming because we talked about it a little while ago, and I have to quote you one of the great popular songs of all times, and then we'll ask about the implications of that. And I'll refrain from horrifying everybody. I won't sing this, but you all know the tune. The lyrics go, it winds from Chicago to L.A., more than 2,000 miles all the way. Get your kicks on Route 66. Now you go through St. Louis, Joplin, Missouri, and Oklahoma City is mighty pretty. Well, I've been to Oklahoma City, and I could maybe argue with that, but it definitely does go through Joplin, Missouri. Now, are there any ramifications for Joplin Public about Route 66, this great American road going through your city?
Route 66 runs right in front of the Joplin Public Library. It is Main Street going through the middle of town, and we sit right on Main Street. So, and we actually have a monument in the front lawn of the library commemorating Route 66.
Really? And when did all that happen?
On the 75th anniversary of the highway, the National Route 66 Association was putting up monuments along the route, and Joplin was one of the sites, of course, that they chose. Joplin actually has two of the monuments, one at the library and one out at the edge of town at Schifferdecker Park.
Fantastic. The only other place I know, the song goes on and talks about Amarillo and Gallup and Flagstaff. Now, Flagstaff, Arizona, I've been to quite a bit, and they do make some fuss about Route 66, so it's nice to know that they're not the only place. Do you ever do programs on Route 66?
We have in the past, yes. We've done several programs. We've had authors in who have done books on Route 66, and we've done displays and programs. And, of course, when we had the dedication of this monument, which was, I believe, in 2001 or 2002, we had a big crowd out on the front lawn, and we played Nat King Cole singing the song, and had a good time.
Oh, fantastic. That's a great version, too, his version of it. So, yeah, it's always interesting when libraries are able to take advantage of some local piece of history like that and kind of play off on it and make... I was doing research on a number of little public libraries a while back, and there's a library up in Minnesota that inherited a new building that used to be a bar, and among other things, they acquired a very large stuffed moose head. And there was some discussion about getting rid of the moose head, but the moose wound up sitting up above the reference desk. And every year at the 4th of July parade, they put the moose head on the bookmobile and go down in the parade, and everybody loves it. So,
well, you know, that's part of the library's history. And it's like when we took down a building across the street. We bought a building across the street to take it down and put in some additional parking. And it was an old building and hadn't been occupied for a number of years. And the contractors found a number of bottles of rum buried underneath the actual floor of the building,
yeah,
between the joists, and we figure at some time they had tax stamps on them from 1941. So we figured it wasn't anything to do with bootlegging, but we have speculated that perhaps at some time somebody was selling Sunday booze.
Well, wasn't Kansas a dry state for a while? Maybe somebody was doing a little entrepreneurial storage there for Kansas residents.
We don't know, but of course, by the time we at the library heard about it, most of the booze had walked away from the site. I was able to salvage one bottle with a good tax stamp on it, and it's now residing in the library safe.
Oh, well, that should go on display, except somebody probably decide maybe they needed some 65-year-old rum and have at it.
I was assured that it was still very drinkable.
Oh, I'm sure it probably is, given that. I personally think rum is vile stuff, but that's just me. So the library building that you're in now, I've looked at the website, this is clearly not the original building.
This building was completed in 1981.
Mm-hmm. And the Carnegie, you've got a Carnegie that opened up in 1902. Now, what happened to that building?
It still exists. It was sold in 1981 to husband and wife who used it as a residence, actually.
Clever.
And but the building was, as you said, built in 1902,
yeah,
and was actually the second Carnegie Grant, or perhaps the third. There's a little confusion. It was the second or the third Carnegie Grant in Missouri. We know that Sedalia was the first, and Jefferson City or Joplin, one of the two was the second and the other was the third.
Believe it or not, I actually have a database that I am now pulling up, and we will settle this question. So is the building still in use as a residence, or did they have to give up on that?
The owner died several years ago, and we believe that we don't know for a fact, but we believe that there may be some attempt to sell it, but we haven't heard that. That's just purely rumor.
Yeah. The best use I ever saw made of an old Carnegie building was in New Mexico, and I can't pull the name of the town up, but somebody'd made a rather charming restaurant out of it, which I thought was pretty good. So let's see here. We have Carnegie Grants. Those are all pretty late. Your Carnegie Grant was 1901.
Yeah, the building was completed in 1901.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, Carthage and Louisiana are both 1902. And
when's Jefferson City?
Jeff City's 1900.
Okay, so we were the third, because
yeah,
I know Sedalia was 1899.
Well, let me look on that. Yep, Sedalia was 1899.
Right.
Jeff City was 1900. Springfield was 1901, and you were 1901.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a two-way tie there for third place. Actually, Missouri did pretty well. We've got, looks like, probably 15 or so Carnegie libraries. Interestingly enough, in the next day or two, you're going to get an email, because I've had one of my classes this semester doing a project on Missouri library history, and we're going to try we're going to have everybody take a look at it and see if we've said anything wrong or silly or stupid or whatever on it. But
well, you know, the Joplin Library was one of the few in Missouri, I don't know how many others, but one of the few that got a second grant for the same building.
Oh, now that's interesting.
The building was completed in 1902, and then in 1908, the board wrote to Carnegie and said, hey, we've run out of space. And he wrote back, or his secretary wrote back and said, well, folks, we won't give you any money, because if you hadn't frittered away some of your original $40,000, you wouldn't, if you had built a building without a, in effect what they did was build a two-story building with a large basement, of course, which was what Carnegie specified. You know, they had to have the daylight basements. But they did not build the second floor as usable library space. They built it to as art display and committee room meeting things and stuff. So when they ran out of book space and asked for more money, he turned them down. So what they did was subdivide the first and the second floors, or the basement and the first floor, into two levels each. So they had four levels of stacks, and they used glass floors for those halfway floors.
Yeah, which was not uncommon at the time.
No, And then they wrote, they didn't give up easily. In 1915, they wrote to him again and asked him for yet more money, and this time he was feeling a little bit more generous, I guess. And he wrote back and he said they could have an additional $20,000.
Yeah.
So they built a two-story addition onto the back. So I think we're one of the very few that got two grants for the same building.
Yeah, that's an interesting story, because by the early years there, Carnegie himself may have still been keeping an eye on things, but by 1915 it was all the secretary of the Carnegie Corporation, James Bertram.
And this letter actually came from Bertram.
Yeah, yeah.
What I found amazing was when they wrote to him initially, they wrote to him in May of 1901 and received an answer from Scotland in July of 1901. You know, nothing works that fast now.
Yeah, I was going to say, try and get a letter from here to Scotland and back in that kind of hurry. And, of course, that was long before airplanes, so somebody was going across the ocean fast.
Well, it wasn't just the response, but it came back and said, yes, you can have the money.
Yeah, yeah. Well, of course, they were, at that stage of the game, pretty much shoveling money out the door. It was known as the wholesale period of Carnegie grants. But, yeah, I love those old buildings. I mean, in terms of functionality, they're ghastly, and I'm sure your new building is, well, relatively new building, is a whole lot better. So.
Right. The new building's all on one level. The original Carnegie had nine levels on the inside. Seven of them in the public area, and there were 18 steps up to the front door.
Yeah,
there wasn't any ground level entrance to the building, and there wasn't parking, and it was just a difficult building to maneuver around in. I've worked in a Carnegie before. I worked at the Carthage Public Library too, which still is used as a library. It's a beautiful little building.
They got their grant in 1902.
Mm-hmm.
And the library opened in 1904, according to what I've got here. So, and it's still in use.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there are some still in use. The one in my hometown in Massachusetts lasted until about 8 years ago. Maybe it's a little longer than that. When the town got a potload of money and converted the building I'd gone to grade school in is now the library. And they don't know what to do with the original Carnegie building, because like your building in Joplin, no parking, no street level access. Anybody with a wheelchair is absolutely, totally out of luck and all that. Now, with the 1980 building, or 81, did you have to do a lot of retrofitting when the internet came in and drape fiber optic everywhere?
In 1980, when this building came about, it was right on the cusp of this technological revolution. And so, no, it was not designed for, it was designed for a book collection. And also, there was a great deal of controversy about the construction of the building, because not only we talked about history with Route 66, but the site was occupied by a huge hotel that was on the National Historic Register and that nationally known, the Connor Hotel. And it had been a derelict for a number of years, but there was a huge amount of sentimental attachment to this hotel. This is where people went for their proms and for their wedding parties, and it had been there since 1906, and it was just, it was a part of downtown Joplin. So,
but the fact that it was a dump didn't seem to carry any weight. I mean,
you know, sentiment carries a lot of weight.
Yeah.
And so when this building was built, it was preceded by several years of very public and quite rancorous wrangling.
And you very cleverly were not there.
I was smart, you know, to not get there until after this was all over. But the building itself is just, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful building. It covers, it stretches the entire length of the block, the 300 block of Main Street.
Uh-huh.
And it is a very beautiful building. But it was not designed for computers or for other types of media, anything that is not books and print-oriented. And it has, a lot of things. You know, there are walls where we would prefer not to have walls. But all in all, it's a lovely building, and it's a nice building to work in.
That's good. I mean, anytime you can get a functional library building out of architects, you're way ahead of the game, since sometimes they tend to run a little amok. My father was an architect, so I can say things like that.
Well, we have added on to this building, too. We added more than double the size of the children's department and added on a large addition back in 1995 and 96.
Yeah. Well, that's good. You know, when the town supports it and you can get the space and all that, and if you've got adequate book space and nobody's gone over to this mania that it's all electronic now, which I'm sure we're all aware that it's a long way from that. So
no, there are going to be people who are going to be reading romances and westerns in bed for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, you and I have talked a couple of times about reading interests. I should share with everybody that Carolyn and I met some years before I got to Missouri. There's the author Patrick O'Brien, who wrote a wonderful series of seafaring novels, and I'm sure some of you have seen the movie Master and Commander, and that's where all that. And there's a discussion board for Patrick O'Brien, and there I was pontificating away on the thing, and Carolyn is wondering, who is this guy anyway?
The desert sailor.
Yeah. Then I moved to Missouri, and she said, "My goodness, there can't be two guys with that same nom de web." So it was indeed me. I've got my collection development class this fall reading genre fiction. In fact, I inflicted Master and Commander on them.
That's no infliction. That's a treat that you gave them.
Well, I'm not sure. I've got two of them in the studio with me, and one is sort of thinking, he's not so sure about that. But Jennifer liked it, apparently, so I think we're ahead of the game there.
Well, you know, Charlie, I was forced into reading it by a friend who badgered me unmercifully until finally, just to shut him up, I said, okay, let me try this. And I can remember distinctly sitting down to read this and feeling like I was laboring under some, you know, just horrible obligation here. And I can remember struggling through the first several pages until I hit a point at which there was this marvelous bit of wordplay that made me laugh out loud.
Yeah.
And that was it. That was the hook. And I stayed up, read the rest of the book that night.
Yeah,
and went out the next day and bought the next four in the series.
Yep, that's
so it was
very close to my experience. My daughter gave me Master and Commander and then Post Captain, the second book, for Christmas one year. And I'd had any number of people say, you know, you really got to read this. You really got to read this. And I thought, yeah. You know, I've read Horatio Hornblower. What do I need to know about the Napoleonic
right.
Wars again? And that opening sequence of Master and Commander in the music room in there, the mm-hmm. two protagonists sitting next. It's such a marvelous piece of writing. And you hit exactly on one of the things that I think... it sometimes takes two trips through, but O'Brien's absolutely amazing, sly, deadpan sense of humor. They'll get these absolutely outrageous jokes, and...
Oh, yeah, I don't think I have ever laughed out loud when reading anything as often as I've laughed out loud. And it's as good the second and the third and the fourth time through. And also, I can probably count on the fingers of two fingers the times that books have made me cry, actually cry. And I have cried real tears when reading O'Brien. And it is a magical experience. And it also solves the one people always ask, you know, what book would you take to a desert island with you? I now have an answer. I wouldn't take. I regard them as just 20 chapters of one big long novel, I would have all 20 volumes.
Yeah, that's a lot of people have made that same observation. It's really just one giant long
mm-hmm.
novel. It just happens to be in 20 volumes.
Mm-hmm.
And no doubt in my mind, that's what I take. Now, I'm a guy.
And while I'm confessing, I should say that it made me cry, but I was also, I heard about O'Brien's death while I was driving through the Flint Hills of Kansas on my way to the funeral of a friend, and so I was already a little. And Bob Edwards came on Morning Edition and said that they had just been notified that Patrick O'Brien had died.
Yeah.
And I pulled off to the side of the road and sat there and wept, because that meant there would be no more books.
Yeah. Well, we got a fragment of one when 21 was published, but...
Yeah, but it's a fragment.
Yeah, it is. I was flabbergasted. I'm a guy, so I can't admit to crying. I sure have laughed a lot over those books, and I was pretty sad. My daughter Jenny got to meet O'Brien on his last book tour. He hit a Barnes & Noble in New York, about three blocks from where my daughter was working. So I have, and you're permitted to scream here, I have a signed Patrick O'Brien.
Well, I don't know. I'm just going to ask if I can touch your hand or kiss your ring, I guess.
Yeah, Jenny's observation was that he was a charming old coot. So.
Well, you know what the big scandal was when he was revealed not to be Patrick O'Brien, and he wasn't Roman Catholic, and he wasn't all of these things. He was masquerading all of his life.
Heavens
so that
to
was
Betsy,
a minor.
He has a nom de plume there.
And that was a minor scandal.
Yeah, well, it's the guy can do anything he wants. If I could write like that, you know, I don't care.
He makes no concessions whatsoever to the reader. He
mm-hmm.
says, you know, you're either with me or, you know, just don't bother to come along.
Yeah.
And it feels like he truly is writing of the time, not
mm-hmm.
or in the time, not just of the time, but in the time as well. Yeah.
I always had this vision of him composing those things with a quill pen on foolscap. I don't think that's quite true. But
right.
I told the class when I assigned the book to him, I said, look, it's perfectly okay to skip parts of this. There are some of those long technical explanations of sailing, you know, I grew up, I know how to sail, I've sailed all my life, and I haven't a clue what's going on in some of that stuff. So,
But see, what I did was I bought books of maps, and I bought books of ship's rigging.
Figure out how it works.
Yeah, figure out what all of this was, yeah. Mm.
Did you get the cookbook?
Yes, I have the cookbook.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. As a matter matter of fact, a friend and I have talked about having a gun room dinner sometime.
Yeah, you're
I don't know that I'll cook drowned baby pudding, but...
Yeah, some of that stuff is wild.
Right.
Because I'm a vegetarian, and all that lard is a little bit much for me. But so how do you deal with genre fiction or convince people you know, the reading interests of adults is really what we're talking about here. And clearly O'Brien is a writer for adults. And there are lots of other, quote, genre fiction pieces that big people read.
But Charlie, see, I wouldn't classify O'Brien as a genre writer. I would say he is a writer of historical fiction and an extraordinarily good writer of historical fiction.
Yeah.
But I would not put that as the same kind of genre that we usually talk about when we talk about romances or science fiction,
right,
or fantasy,
right,
or westerns, all of which are very legitimate, you know, romances, for heaven's sake. You know, romances account for about half of all paperback fiction sales,
mm-hmm,
and they account for a third, I think, of all fiction sales, whether paperback, hardback,
mm-hmm,
anything. So, you know, that's a very legitimate genre that we have looked down our noses at for a long, long time, and it's a shame that we do that.
I had the class read a romance novel, and I actually read the thing, too.
Well, you are to be commended.
Which amazed me somewhat. Well, it was interesting. It was a Regency, 1803, and I got interested in kind of the historical details in it, a number of which things proved to be absolutely true. I mean, let's face it, it wasn't Jane Austen, and and I probably won't bother to read another one.
But not many things are Jane Austen.
Well, yeah, that's true, and it's telling one more thing on O'Brien. Jane Austen was one of his favorite writers, and I think we'd probably better leave Patrick alone, or we'll have everybody asleep here.
You know, we forgot that we were talking about libraries and just went off on our favorite little.
Well, it was, but I was kind of working around towards that adult reading issue there and talking about, now, how do you do romance novels at Joplin, for instance?
Well, we buy romances in large print, particularly. We buy a lot of them, and we have been having, as it's a perennial debate about whether you separate out genre fiction from,
mm-hmm,
from others,
mm-hmm,
and of course every list I'm on has this debate at least once a year. The Missouri Public Library directors had a huge debate about this here several months ago. At Joplin, we do not have separate genre collections. We put stickers on the spine, which of course is not what a lot of our other libraries in the state do. So,
mm-hmm,
you know, this is just something. It gives us an excuse to have something to argue about.
Well, this is. I mean, we've had kind of that discussion in class, and a lot of play. You know, everybody said, "Well, there's advantages to putting everything off because the people that really want to read it can just zero in on that collection." And of course, the flip side is well, who knows what they're going to find by serendipity. And the whole labeling issue did get risen up. Santa Fe Public, which is the one I've spent the most time in, does separate out mysteries and science fiction. I'm not sure how,
mm-hmm,
they handle romance or westerns. Although, of course, in Santa Fe, it's sort of local as opposed to westerns, but that's another issue. So we're getting down towards the bottom of the half hour here. Let me ask you, what's the most exciting thing you've been able to do or accomplish as director of Joplin Public?
Oh, there are a couple. One of the things was getting an increase in our levy passed by a total of 42 votes. We considered that to be.
Wow.
And it's time to look at that again. That was some years ago. In terms of being exciting, you know, every day has been exciting in one way or another. We have managed to continue to provide good service with not very much money, which is always exciting. Dealing with patrons is always exciting. And I can honestly say that I have never once, since I started working libraries, got up in the morning and not wanted to go to work.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So what's your vision for the future? You're sort of edging along towards retirement, as I recall a conversation you and I had on this topic.
My vision of the future is sort of limited right now in terms of how far ahead the future is. But my vision of the future is that, you know, I really don't know what's going to happen in the future. 10 years ago, there is no way in the world I could have guessed that where we are today is where we would have been.
Yeah.
There is no way to know. I do believe that we have to look at wholesale change and be prepared for wholesale change. One of the things that librarians suffer from is a tendency to hang on to what we have done in the past, and we have to get rid of that mental block.
Well, there's a certain amount to be said for continuity.
Oh, yeah, of course.
On the other hand, you're dead right. I'm thinking about, you know, I started in library land in 1970-something or other.
And, so did I.
I think we've had this conversation before, too. But certainly the last 10 years, maybe the last 12, there's been more change in our field than in the whole time before that.
Right.
You know, you can really make an argument that everything that happened from, say, around 1900 or 1905, maybe when Library of Congress started selling cards, up to the late 80s,
you're right,
was really functionally just the same thing. We'd sped things up a little bit electronically, but since the advent of the Internet, blast you, Tim Berners-Lee, we're really in a fundamentally different milieu, and libraries are kind of struggling to figure out what our role is and where we're going to be and all that. But
well, not just the advent of the Internet, but also the migration away from purely print.
Yeah.
The inclusion of all sorts of audio and visual materials in library collections.
Yeah, but the great bulk of circulation is still print materials, I think. Although, on the other hand, we don't know what's being hit on the web page either. So it's we're in for interesting times, I think, and
right.
Or our successors will be anyway.
So. Right. The ancient Chinese curse. Right?
Yep. Well, Carolyn, I want to thank you for being on Show Me Libraries.
Well, this has been fun.
I'm glad it's been fun, and we will doubtless, you and I will chat again. For those of you who may or may not be listening in, the next really big scheduled program we'll have is the first Tuesday program next month, December. I'll be interviewing Janet Swan Hill, who is director of, or head of technical services at University of Colorado Boulder. We're going to be talking about catalogers, cataloging, the lack thereof, and what library land might do about all that. And in the meantime, we hope everybody enjoys this, and you have lisradio.missouri.edu bookmarked, and we'll see you all next time. And we are out of here.